Welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices from the social design movement from the fields of architecture, planning, and art, co-hosted by Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation and the Curry Stone Design Prize. This is the second part of a live podcast recorded at the South by Southwest Conference in Austin, Texas, on March 13th, 2017, with guests Pliny Fisk and Gail Vittori of the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems.
I want to get back to this idea of byproducts and back to the question of, you know, can a city work as an ecosystem? Pliny said something about evolution, and it sort of set me off. Before the interview, Emiliano and I were talking about, you know, the nature of ecosystems and how you can have, you know, a 10,000-acre mangrove forest. But what happens on this square meter of that mangrove forest has a relationship and contributes to the overall health of the system and vice versa. And it seems like, you know, maybe in the second half of the 20th century, we took the opposite view to our cities. We decided that there were some areas that were worth improving and some areas worth neglecting. And we did that at a national scale, too. You know, we're going to produce all of our joy and our art and our economic activity over here, and we're just going to put all of our waste over there. How do we move forward into the future in terms of recognizing the fundamental fallibility of the latter approach and the supreme wisdom of the former approach?
Well, we have an hour left. Well, it's sort of interesting. I mean, my training is in ecological land planning, and it did exactly what you just said. Let's reserve, don't touch. But in actuality, we're touching in all directions. So what do you do about the fact that you are touching? So we did this whole thing about reevaluating the whole ecological land planning approach, and we call it eco-balance, so that you're actually beginning to look at the, you know, the bookends. Here's conservation. Take that and don't touch it. Fine. Then there's, you know, the disaster areas and the floods and so on. Don't touch it. Stay out of those too. What do you do in between? So what do you do in between has a lot to do with, you know, a series of tools that are available to us. I mean, a lot of people know permaculture. A lot of people know ZERI, Zero Emissions Research Institute in Germany. So these guys are actually beginning to say the human participation in trying to take a resource and evolve it into a use for humans and balancing that each time, water, food, energy, materials, every time you're doing something, you're actually able to improve the land so that people's participation is not this no-touch, conserve, but actually beginning to get into businesses and ways of doing things that are actually helping people and nature together.
It's also recognizing the importance of doing things at the smallest scale possible. And so rather than relegating a certain area away to take care of a problem, how does the issue of the problem be addressed at the scale at which it's generated? If it's not possible to be done at that scale, then how is there a consciousness about the scalar need to get it to a place where it can be managed and to be introducing that notion of visibility again. So we have another protocol called Visible Green, which is trying to get as much physical, visible representation of what it is we're doing and how we're responding to and relating to and depending on broader, larger scales to support what we're doing here. That's mostly invisible. And so the more we can bring it into a visibility, we think that connects people in a very conscious way to enable us all to make better decisions because we see it right in front of us.
And you begin to realize in that small, very tactile, in front of you level, how much design counts and how design is a communicator tool at all scales. And, you know, is that table, you know, the amount of wood in it and the amount of metal in it, a balanced carbon entity related to life cycle? And the fact is we found that a lot of furniture can be, but if you don't keep that wood, and it goes to the recycling place, or it begins to go to the dump, or it begins to go whatever, that balance equation, that the amount of carbon in that wood, actually balancing the life cycle carbon of the steel, goes poof, the equation's gone. So it's very interesting. Keep that table, as long as you possibly can, and that's an internally embodied carbon balance table.
I think it's an enormous innovation engine to be thinking about how to be responsible for what we do, whether it's the negative side of it or the positive side of it. So if folks were to come out to our office, for example, the pathway to our front door is our wastewater treatment system. And we celebrate it. We make it very visible. It's beautiful. It is part of the broader aesthetic of the entire project, the building. And what's important is that it is something that everyone interacts with. They may or may not be aware that it's a wastewater treatment system. Oftentimes when we describe that, they're sniffing around trying to figure out, like, why doesn't this stink? And it confounds their notion about what a wastewater treatment system is. So the design opportunity to say these parts of our systemic reality can actually be beautiful, they can be inspiring, and you know what? Whether we like it or not, that's part of what our embrace is. That's part of our footprint on this planet. And so let's take the opportunity to be graceful and elegant and have it be something that we can be proud of, and not something that we feel has to be pushed aside and somehow it becomes the burden of a population that may not have a choice about what it is that is put in their backyard.
But what I really think that is so relevant about the research that you guys have been doing is that you have been, in fact, testing all these technologies. So between water treatment, solar energy, and all kinds of technologies that make our world more sustainable. And specifically, I find incredible a project that you guys have been working, that is a project for Morocco, in which you were planning an entire city in the desert. That seemed like a nonsense project because, you know, how could you build a city that is sustainable in the desert? But it seemed as all the different aspects of that ecology seemed sorted out, from the production of food to the treatment of water, energy. Could you maybe tell us a bit more about the project?
So it's sort of a condition where, you know, the desert is this, you know, continually drawing condition of water, resources, transportation, all the things, but it has a lot of sun, and underneath that sand is saline water. So saline water is intruding all over the world. So wouldn't it be interesting that you almost develop a opposite of the, what's the cave guys that go down versus the ones that go up?
I can never remember. Stalagmites and stalactites.
Sorry. So here you can grow by taking some of that water out and extracting that magnesium oxide out of it. And actually, the magic of this material is that it sets within 20 minutes to 90% of structural strength. So all of a sudden, you're beginning to realize, my goodness, you have a huge 3D printer. You can extract. You can take the waste from the mine. The mine is a huge phosphate mine, because one of the other things that you need in this cement is the waste in that phosphate mine to mix with that magnesium oxide. And together, they're producing buildings that can actually be, you know, manufactured very sensibly and very quickly with no water virtually at all, except for the salt water that you're bringing up. So the ecology right from the get-go begins to be a very relevant way of thinking. And then it compiles a whole lot of other things. How do you do food in these situations? How do you actually do your photovoltaics in a way where it is a translucent photovoltaic that actually brings a wavelength in underneath all the panels in the desert that actually can grow food? It's been proven up to 18% better and more food than the normal sun. So you're using your photovoltaic panels in a very different way. You're actually using them as a filter as well as a generator of electricity. So the ecology of sort of totally connecting to that place and their problem, which is 45% of the phosphate produced in the world from anything from agriculture to your soap, comes from those mines. So how do you reverse that and begin to say, hey, you know, build in the mine, begin to use the waste resources, begin to use some of that water, and you're looking at the mountains in the distance, and you're beginning to see, wow, what is in those mountains? And they're within, you know, 30 miles of the site. You begin to realize a very sophisticated material sits there, and it can be mixed with that cement and reinforced, and therefore the reinforcement of, you know, and you saw these wild towers of 800 foot tall. Is that what, did you see this?
Mm-hmm.
So 800 foot, how do you do that? So here you're beginning to say, wow, so there's a very high temperature, and here you have high temperature with the sun in the desert, to sinter and to make basalt rock into a thread that is unbelievably strong thread that can be used as a reinforcement into this cement, and you can produce very elegant, almost bone-type structures where, you know, you look at the foamed and you look at a bird bone and it's foamed in the middle. You look at the outside of the bone and it actually has this stress skin. So you can do both these things using the same material within how you build in the desert because it's all sitting there.
And how do you get ideas like that adopted? I mean, my question was going to be, is the future technological or cultural in terms of, you know, what do we have to transcend? And listening to you guys talk, you know, there are all these fascinating technologies which already exist that are smarter, cheaper, more efficient, more sustainable, et cetera, et cetera. How do we improve the uptake of these sorts of ideas into public consciousness and into public policy?
You get people with a shitload of money listening to you.
Okay, well, that's a good start.
Well, I think part of it is our strong belief that having the work evolve into physical form so that it exists. So how do we find opportunities to take some bit of this, it might not be the whole thing, but some part of it, and get it out there in something that people can actually experience? That then shifts it from being a concept to being real. No one can dispute it. How do you then get a large enough population, people who are influential, whether it's a code issue or on the politics side, or get some money behind it so something can shift from a prototype to actually go through a commercialization process? And so we think that our role is really on the prototype side. We look for opportunities with people that we collaborate with to take what might be a single prototype to a next scale and to enable more exposure to happen. I think fly ash, acknowledging that there's issues with it, I think we did that with fly ash by having our building being 100% fly ash, no Portland cement. We didn't know of any building anywhere that had completely eliminated Portland cement. And so as we showed that, it became the proof of concept that then people in the codes industry, people in the concrete industry and cement industry, public policy realm, were able to see that, and we helped to advance the use of fly ash as a substitute for Portland cement that's now part of codes all over the United States and globally as well. So I think it's a process. I think some of it is about the luck of timing, the coincidence of having a client that might be interested in moving an idea beyond the prototype phase to something that gets more out into the public sphere of application and commercialization. And then I think it's persistence. I think it's just staying with some of these things so that it's going to, we're not going away. And yeah. I think there's others out there who are similarly persistent and making sure that the examples continue to be accessible and available and in the public discourse of the solutions that really need to be part of the defining of our next generation of work.
And you got to be ready. I mean, maybe the money isn't there, but there's another opportunity. And so here you're looking, so here in Belize, so we're coming back to the Belize situation, and, you know, the coral reef is really important. They're getting inundated with the saline waters as well as much of the world. And so you begin to realize, oh my goodness, they have a phosphate problem in their wastewater, in their river that grows the algae. So we did a little bit of work, and we began to realize that there are some companies in the U.S. who are trying to get that phosphate out in order to improve the water in the river and the estuary and so on. And so now, for the first time, we've taken that phosphate out of that wastewater and mixed it, and that's the fifth sample over there that no one can see, that actually takes some of that phosphate and works it along those lines to actually connect into the water issue and pollution issue in a totally different way than what we were doing in, where was it, Morocco.
Say one other. So again, the work that we do focus on protocols, prototypes, and policies. I think one of the best examples that we can share in our work was the basic idea of what became the Austin Energy Green Building Program in 1989, a concept, a way of thinking about buildings really as systems that at the time green building wasn't even known. We had an opportunity to share that concept with people at the City of Austin who were interested in moving forward some idea for a grant proposal. And between 1989 and 1992, the concept evolved sufficiently that it was recognized at the UN Earth Summit in 1992. It was just an idea of a way of thinking, saying, let's think about buildings as being a confluence of the flows of energy, water, waste, and materials. That was the basic idea. Timing really was everything because it was advanced at a moment in time when the world was coming together around a very big series of issues regarding the state of the global environment at the UN Earth Summit in Rio. And the idea that was then presented by the City of Austin, our collaboration with them, was the only program that was recognized at the UN Earth Summit of 12 that were recognized in this particular awards program for local environmental initiatives. That 1992 was a year before the U.S. Green Building Council was formed, which was introducing a way of thinking that really picked up on what was happening in Austin and other places, and then the rest really, you could say, is history. So how do you scale an idea? It's a combination of all kinds of things that can happen. I think what we would hope to be contributing along with others who are doing this kind of work is just a clarity of focus that revolves around some fundamental principles that are shareable to a broad population for whom there is broad benefit and positive outcome. This is really about the big we in this, and we learn as much from working with others as I think anyone ever learns from us. And so keeping that open-mindedness and knowing that we have a long set of successes that are really going to be needed to tackle the array of issues that face us, from the social end of the dimension of the issue to the resource end and economics and all of that. This is really about just finding opportunities, working with others, and continuing to learn and do.
And as you'll see tomorrow, we are very design conscious, because most people's entry into all this complexity is, wow, I'd like to live there, or that's beautiful, or many of those things, that this is the first point of contact. So as you come out, and you guys are going to come out tomorrow, and we invite anybody here that has the time, they're going to be there at what, 9:30 tomorrow, where we actually present our methodologies as really very beautiful ways of thinking. They're graphically good, they engage, they connect people. And so we sort of take this attitude that thinking and thinking well is as important as doing buildings well. So we're going to have up for you all to have you see our beauty of thinking. And hopefully you think the buildings are beautiful too.
Sounds amazing. And we'll bring the coffee and the tacos. I have one more question. It's very selfish and American focused. Would you indulge me, my co-host Emiliano? I'm curious. Our world has really been turned upside down by our world. Certainly, I mean, America's, perhaps to an extent, the rest of the world as well. And, as leaders in this social design movement, I'm wondering, how has your thinking changed now that we seem to be encountering a government that, rather than treating, the environment with a sort of benign neglect, is crossed over to an outright hostility? Does it make you reevaluate the tactics that you've been using for the last 30, 40 years? And are you contemplating something new and more radical and exciting that you can tell us about?
Well, there's one thing. I don't know whether we should talk about it, though, yet. But we've been asked to advise the Austin Green Building Program again after 25 years of their celebration. So what's the next 25 years? And one of the things that we're thinking seriously about is to actually get rid of rating systems the way we know them.
Wow.
And to actually begin to... Now, in our case, we have a pretty special city here. And in our case, our utility has information about all the buildings and their performance. So the feedback month to month can be extraordinary. How did you do this month? So as you do good work, you actually get monetary recompense for doing that good work on the spot that month and the next month. So we think this strange world that we're getting into that is sort of so business related that maybe there's some feedback mechanisms that doesn't say, hey, you got 2 points because you did well with your rainwater catchment system. How much did you catch? How much did it make a difference in the economics of how that building worked during an off season that we are in big trouble as a city? Wow, those guys should be rewarded for doing that, and that should be advertised in a big feedback, immediate way of operating.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that this is really a time to focus on performance and outcomes and outputs. And I think we have the advantage because of decades of work towards developing solutions, of showing the economic, the environmental, the social benefit of a lot of it, of a lot of what we know is actually a reality, and being much bolder about broadcasting the results, because I think that is going to be compelling. It's very clear now that as much as there may be rhetoric about re-engaging the coal industry, that there's really no economic basis for doing that any longer. And so that shift in terms of what might be rhetorically compelling to some people, but what is economically now becoming a reality, it's the economics that's going to be the driver, not the rhetorical statement. And so in that regard, I am trying to be optimistic about what the future holds, because of all the good work that's happened over so many decades, that we know how to do a lot of this stuff. And we also have a contextual reality, which is demanding that these solutions come forward, so that they are going to, that they're going to be what more people do. I just today in the paper read a statement which really stuck with me, even though I have to read it, which is, power concedes nothing without demand, never has, never will, which was a statement by Frederick Douglass. And I think the demand that we have the opportunity to put forward is essentially our knowledge of what is needed.
And what's possible. If we had one more sample there, which I don't, so you just have to imagine it, and that is, it's sort of interesting, and Gail hates it when I go over this, so we do have a little bit of disagreement at times. It's 99% perfect. There's only 1%. But in this case, it's interesting that some coals are actually so polluting that you shouldn't ever, ever touch them. So you've got the lignite coals, and here the lignite coals are the worst. But it's sort of interesting the fact that if you look at coal in general, as you might imagine, it has all the trace elements and everything in it, that all the plants for that period of time in the global evolution had. You know, good stuff, bad stuff. So let's just say good stuff for the moment. Good stuff is extraordinary in that coal because you can build soil with the extraordinary stuff. Can you take out the bad stuff? Can you bioremediate? Can you pull out the cadmiums and the this and the that? That is totally possible. But there are now businesses out there that do not take coal and burn it. They're taking coal, pulverizing it, hopefully getting the bad stuff out, getting it into the soil to build soil. You take that along with what's called biochar, because that's charcoal next to it. So there are two black things that have totally different futures. Biochar, as we know, you put in the soil and it holds the nutrients. That's how the Amazon and these ancient cities existed, in poor soil conditions. So it's a very interesting thing that could you combine things that normally one does not think about combining at all, and they're the opposites. But here there's a touch point that says, wow, you could actually do an energy system that does not use the coal, but uses what is growing out of the coal to produce that charcoal that actually can build the soil. So it's a very different kind of ecology. Now, one of the things you're going to see tomorrow is we try to do this stuff. So you can see gardens and so on that are built, you know, based on the biochar. We have fertilizers by companies out there that are based on that coal. There's a lot of reality to what we're saying, and hopefully when you come out, you'll say, wow.
Sure we will.
Oh, sure. Maybe just to conclude, I mean, the center has been running for more than 40 years, and I think now there's more and more a new consciousness on the importance of the work that you guys have been doing, but also that other practices have been experimenting. What would be your advice to, you know, to young practitioners that are starting now in terms of how to address this practice and how to learn more about these technologies?
It's sort of an interesting question because some people asked us that the other day, how many organizations are like you in the United States? And it's a little bit sad that, you know, there are not a lot of design, build, practice, out on the limb organizations anymore. Now, there were once quite a number. So as I look back in the appropriate technology days, I could go all over the world and you find lots of places like us, which are sort of one-stop shops for looking at not materials or food or this or that, but really a collection of things. So those institutions and efforts around the country, around the world, now become really, really important. And what I would do, and I suggested this to our intern from Brazil the other day, and I said, you know, there are places in Brazil that are really good places. They might not be doing as 40 years of work, but good places. So where do I go, Plenty? So there's a book that Paul Hawken put together called The Blessed Unrest. And The Blessed Unrest is all us people that feel as though no one's going to support us, we never have enough money, but we're doing cool, great, really important stuff. So he made a list. So the back of that book goes topic by topic around the world in a humongous database, and those, that Blessed Unrest has to be pulled up by its bootstraps and say, you're important, get out there, communicate with each other, and make yourselves more known. Yeah. So that's what I'd suggest.
And I would just add that I think we, having interns come into the center from all kinds of different backgrounds and different countries, I think one of the common themes that we hear from people is that we haven't been asked to think as much in our prior place, whether it's school or work, as we're being asked to think here. And I think that that is really a sad commentary on what is happening, where aspirations and expectations often get tamped down as opposed to given an opportunity to flourish and really expand and explore. So I think that we offer an environment that I would encourage everyone in their context to really look for and to push for, which is to ask the biggest question that you can think of and begin to on the journey to see what you can discover about that. That is where I think the magic is going to happen, and we need that.
I think that's a beautiful place to close, and perhaps a new personal motto, ask the biggest question that you can. So I think we'd like to thank you both for joining us, and thanks to our live audience as well as to our virtual audience. Emiliano, do you want to close us out?
No, please, to everybody, I hope everybody will have the chance to visit the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems soon, because it's an extremely inspiring place, and I hope that more of these places were actually of true experimentation will actually germinate in the upcoming years. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
You've been listening to the second and final part of a special edition of Social Design Insights, hosted by Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi, with guests Pliny Fisk and Gail Vittori of the Center for Maximum Potential Building Systems in Austin, Texas. This was recorded before a live audience at South by Southwest in Austin on March 13, 2017. Please visit our website, currystonedesignprize.com, to hear part one of this edition and all of the editions of Social Design Insights. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation and the Curry Stone Design Prize. Please find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the latest in Social Design Insights. Thank you for listening.